Tehran.
Rubashave Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It was a referendum that would change Britain's future forever. 52% of those who turned out to vote in 2016 chose to leave the EU, setting to motion years of negotiations and changes to laws and legislation. The man championing the cause, Nigel Farage.
We will be leaving this prison of nations at the end of January. And we won't become a third country, as I've been hearing this morning. No, we're going to become an independent, self-governing nation.
A nation that voted in Brexiteer-in-chief, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, to power, who promised an oven-ready post-Brexit deal with the EU and prosperity for Britons. 6 years on and five prime ministers later, the country is facing an economic downturn, expected to last until 2024, and a de facto general strike by public sector workers over pay and conditions.
Small and large businesses up and down the country have been feeling the impact of Brexit in different ways, from added paperwork on borders to shortages of labor. In October, a Confederation of British Industry report said that three-quarters of UK companies have been hit by labor shortages in the past year.
Since the new Brexit rules took effect at the start of 2021, EU nationals no longer have the freedom to work in the UK. Instead, a new points-based immigration system has been implemented to attract skilled workers. Marlise Hazelton has lived here for nearly 40 years.
I can't even get citizenship, and it feels a bit like an insult, because I'm part and parcel of this country, really. I'm part of the furniture, and I've lost that sense of home.
The UK's withdrawal from the EU has also impacted the country's trade. After the pandemic, trade in almost all G7 nations has been recovering. The one exception is the UK, thanks to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
You can compare Britain with what's going on in Europe, you see, because they've also suffered the Ukraine shock, they've suffered that. So we can look at the data and see how Britain is doing relative to the average of those EU countries that are most similar to us. And it's those statistics that show that the British economy is 4% smaller, investment about 10% smaller than it would otherwise be.
The predictions for next year's GDP growth show a similar story. According to the OECD predictions, the British economy is not likely to grow in 2023. It's estimated to perform worse than advanced economies like China, Canada, and Japan. Even developing nations such as Indonesia are ahead of the UK. And one country below Britain is Russia, which is currently under heavy economic sanctions. As Britain faces a winter of discontent on a par with the one in 1978, it's become increasingly more evident that it's Britain that risks becoming the lame duck of the G7 due to Brexit and Brexit alone. Saeed Purza, London.
Fuel prices have slightly dropped in Yemen after the release of two Yemeni fuel ships that were detained by the Saudi-led coalition earlier this week in the Red Sea. The Yemeni army issued a stern warning to Saudi Arabia and the UAE that if the ships were not released soon, military action would follow. Yemeni bus and motorbike drivers in the capital Sana'a, who make a living from public transportation, welcomed the lowering of fuel prices. They say this is going to help them cope with the fuel price hike caused by the blockade.
As you can see, I am pumping 1 liter for only 500 Yemeni rials, whereas before it used to cost us 1,500 to 2,000 for 1 liter.
The Saudi-led coalition who are seizing Yemeni fuel ships do not respond to peaceful dialogue. They only respond to us when we decide to use our military power, and if that's the case, so be it.
Yemeni political expert says the release of the fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition isn't enough, as Yemen will continue to struggle until Saudi Arabia and its allies completely lift the blockade and end their illegal involvement in Yemen.
Although the price of fuel has slightly dropped, we still need to look at the more pressing issue, and that is the fact that the Saudi-led coalition is still occupying Yemen. We need to reach an ultimate solution that can only come through taking decisive military actions against them. This is the only solution.
Despite falling oil prices, tensions are rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen for what could soon be a resumption of war if a political solution is not reached soon. This as Saudi Arabia and the UAE continue their militarization of strategic Yemeni islands in the Red and Arabian Sea.
The release of Yemeni fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition marks a big victory for the Yemeni government based in Sana'a and to the people living in the areas controlled by Ansar Allah. This also indicates that Saudi Arabia and the UAE simply cannot afford to have their oil industry targeted by Yemeni ballistic missiles, which is why they chose a safer option by releasing the fuel vessels. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
...2022 has been dominated by a cost of living crisis, and the figures are staggering. Inflation is running at a double-digit pace, the highest in 40 years, and far outpacing wage growth. While food prices have shot up almost 20%, and the cost of heating a typical home has jumped more than 150%. As temperatures plummet below zero and desperation rises, key sector worker unions have launched mass strike actions to pressure the government to force wage rises.
The people who are out here on strike today are the same people who not only worked through the pandemic, we worked for the people, we'd get their prescriptions, we'd get their milk and bread.
We just want a pay rise in line with the cost of living. At the moment, what we're getting is actually terms of a pay cut. So it's not even in line with inflation. Everything's gone up. We're just like everybody else. We're all struggling.
This is not about pay. This is about our jobs.
The situation has become so dire in Britain that many families will have to choose whether to heat their homes or feed their families this Christmas.
It is very distressing. It's a situation which, in a way, unimaginable for a country which is supposed to be one of the richest countries in Europe and in the West. Why is it we have these extremes of poverty? Why are people... Some people forced to choose between heating and eating. I mean, there's something completely wrong about our system. We should be plugging and supporting and promoting equality and, you know, not oppressing the poor. You know, there's something which says a lot about our political system, which is flawed.
The government has pinned much of the blame on economic recovery from the COVID era. However, critics say its ruling Conservative Party incompetence and leadership instability that has also left the economy in a dire state. A lesser discussed reason for a European-wide crisis is the ongoing Ukraine war. Britain has remained a staunch supporter of continued fighting, even upping its shipments of arms and financial support.
I think the first is ensuring that we deliver more military aid and that that military aid evolves to meet the situation that we're now facing. And that means more air defence systems, it means artillery, it means armoured vehicles. For our part in the United Kingdom, we've pledged to match or exceed the £2.3 billion in aid that we provided this year, next year.
Low wages, higher fuel costs, inflation and major strike action have all marred 2022. Does the government have what it takes to resolve these many issues in 2023? Probably not. It's going to be a long road with most likely higher taxation, major cuts in public spending and renewed pressure on an already struggling British working class. Robert Carter, London.
The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly, terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to Treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former Prime Minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 23rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we have been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they wouldn't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
And it's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table. The Yemeni government based in the capital Sana'a has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's called the Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization. A march against Morocco's normalization with Israel to mark the second anniversary of Morocco's so-called normalization with the Tel Aviv regime. The turnout massive. Moroccans in nearly 30 cities protested against this so-called normalization, chanting anti-normalization slogans and raising Palestinian flags. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why so many of the residents of Persian Gulf Arab countries are against what has been called the Abraham Accords, and whether the countries that normalized made any gains from it. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator at Samidon Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, Mazen Khumsaya, who's a Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem. Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, Charlotte Cates, looking at what Morocco has done today in terms of the protests on the one hand, but when you take a look at how it's renewed these relations with Israel, which it did last year in terms of initiating it, but it comes 2 decades after it actually cut ties with the outbreak of the second Palestinian Intifada with the Israeli regime back then. How did it go from an Intifada, which led to cutting ties, to now having the so-called normalization of ties with Israel?
One thing that we have seen is a concerted effort by the imperialist powers that are backing up reactionary Arab regimes and monarchies to impose this form of normalization and to attempt to push the Palestinian cause off of the agenda once and for all. There's been an attempt to redirect the compass of the Arab nation from fighting for national liberation and the liberation of Palestine to instead being directed against the enemies of imperialism, for example, in Iran. Well, the reality is, just like we saw in kind of the popular participation in the World Cup and the expressions of the Moroccan football team, that the Arab people have never agreed to normalization with Zionism and will never agree to normalization with Zionism. And so these imperialist schemes that have involved these reactionary rulers do nothing to represent the interests of the people of Morocco or the Arab people more broadly. And what's been shown and what's really clear and what the resistance in Palestine is making clear on a daily basis is that, in fact, Palestine is not off the agenda. Palestine remains the central Arab cause, and no efforts at normalization have ever done anything for Arab people and only support the interests of those who are seeking to oppress Arabs across the board.
The demonstrations that took place, Mazen Khumsaya, in Morocco was quite extensive and it was vast. I mean, we're not just talking about Rabat, which was the most turnout, but over 30 cities from what we understand, or around 30 cities across the country. Now, that's pretty big in terms of the turnout. How much of a danger does that pose when you have the ones on top normalizing with Israel, which goes against what fervor these their population has when it comes to the Palestinian issue?
Well, for us here in Palestine, these demonstrations were a shot in the arm. They uplift our spirits, they make us stronger, and we really appreciate it. I was actually watching, just before I joined you, I was watching this Al-Hiwar TV talking to Jamal Al-Usri, who is the coordinator of the Moroccan Front in Solidarity of Palestine against the normalization with Israel. And it was uplifting to hear him say things like, Palestine amana and tatbi' khiyana, which means Palestine is basically on our shoulders, and any normalization is treachery. And the Moroccan people have said this loud and clear today on the second anniversary of this horrible signature by the monarchy in Morocco in support of an oppressor, in support of a colonizer. So we, the Palestinian people here under occupation, under oppression, where we had 230 people already killed in 2022, you know, where we had over 6,000 arrested or jailed, over 3,000 injured, 15 to 20% of all those are children. We are really grateful for this effort by the Moroccan people to overturn this very unjust decision, unilateral decision by their government, which has no basis in any popular support.
Charlotte Cates, our guest there, talked about the head of the Moroccan Observatory Against Normalization, who made a statement saying Morocco's agreements with Israel are contributing to a crime, that these agreements are a new wave of Zionist penetration, as it described it, blatant attempt to humiliate the dignity of Moroccans and strike at all of Morocco's obligations towards the Palestinians. So you have that, and then you have the U.S. Secretary of State, an achievement that has deepened ties, partnerships, and avenues to pursue shared goals. Positive step for the region as we aim to widen the circle of peace. I mean, we're looking at the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of what is being relayed out there. Why do you think there's such extremes when it comes to this different narrative that we're looking at here?
Well, look at the role of the United States. The United States provides $3.8 billion in military aid, with an additional $1 billion added on this year of arms and weaponry for the slaughter and oppression of the Palestinian people. In fact, it's the United States that has been primarily behind all of these efforts to forcibly impose normalization on the Arab people, from Morocco to the Emirates and elsewhere. The United States has been the primary pusher and mover in attempting to force normalization on Arabs and to redirect the Arab people away from the central struggle for the liberation of Palestine and into internal conflict or into rivalries with other regional powers. And the fact is that the Arab people have always rejected this and continue to reject that. And we can see that in these demonstrations that took the streets of Morocco to forcibly and clearly rebuke and reject this normalization agreement. And we've seen that from the beginning, that this has never been accepted. The United States, as an imperialist power that wants to control and dominate the region for the profit of its military-industrial complex and huge corporations, well, it benefits from the division of the Arab people, and it benefits also from attempting to set Arabs and, say, Iran against each other rather than against the real common enemy, which is that same imperial force that is seeking to impose Zionism on Palestine and normalization on the people of the region. Zionism has always been a weapon in the hands of imperialism. And so it comes as no surprise that the U.S. Secretary of State, who is directly responsible and involved in every single war crime and crime against humanity being committed against the Palestinian people on a daily basis, is also pushing for this kind of normalization. But the reality is that the failure and these demonstrations show that the United States' influence is not dominant and, in fact, is losing ground by the day.
Okay, so Amasa Gumsaye, when you want to take a look at the U.S. role, it's not as if the Abraham Accords, as it was called, was a trial and error, that they didn't know what was going to be the reaction. We're looking at decades, perhaps, of a U.S. role which was basically supporting Israel, but going about it through different ways, perhaps, coming out on the surface that, you know, giving the impression, at least, that there may be support for the Palestinians, but really facts on the ground speak otherwise. But who is the U.S. trying to fail in terms of the role that it has played? Because we know that before the Abraham Accords, while they were in the process of writing it, they were probably sure that it's not going to fly that well with the Palestinians. Let's take a look at the deal of the century. Did that go well? No, it didn't. Or any other incentives that the U.S., as well, they want to call themselves an impartial broker, but they weren't. So how would you define the U.S. role?
Well, the U.S. role, as mentioned by the other speaker, has been a disruptive role. It's been a role that promotes war and conflict to keep Palestinians and other Arabs basically fighting each other rather than thinking about their oppression. And this has failed and is failing, as pointed out also. I think part of the issues were crystallized in the World Cup games in Qatar, where the Moroccan team raised the Palestinian flag after its win in the 3-4 stage, and all the Arab people were raising Moroccan and Palestinian flags. This has been a remarkable transformation, and it must have shocked the rulers of the Gulf states and also the rulers of Morocco and Jordan and Egypt, and must have riled them up because they realized that the so-called, as you point out, the so-called normalization, because that word is really a negative, you know, it's not really a correct word. It's collusion, collaboration, partnership in crimes, if you want. That's what it is. So it has been a very interesting phenomenon to watch this. In a way, I'm glad this is happening because it exposes, as you said, the polarization. Polarization of what? Between what's right and what's wrong. It's becoming so clear to the rest of the world that there's a hypocrisy from the Western world when they are sanctioning Russia for the occupation, supposed occupation of parts of Ukraine that are speaking Russian. And at the same time, they provide billions of dollars to a state, a regime that basically has oppressed millions of Palestinians and resulted in 8 million of us being refugees or displaced people. This is the hypocrisy that's becoming so blatant and so clear. And I wouldn't want to be in the place of those rich Western supported Arab leaders, because I must be squirming, worrying about what's coming next. And I think what's coming next, they have a right to be worried, because their regimes are going to collapse unless they really make a radical change, which I don't foresee.
Indeed. Let's talk about this World Cup and the way that it went down, if we can, Charlotte Case. I mean, this wasn't a case looking at some of the footage of the reactions of the spectators that were there, that they said, no, I'm sorry, we don't want to talk to you. There was extreme anger that came out in terms of the way they relayed when they found out. It was shock, I should say, when they found out it was an Israeli reporter who was asking the questions. So why was that such an eye-opener for many? And why did that become so revealing about how citizens of Arab countries feel about Palestinians? And will it, as our guest there said, and I want to use his verb, make the leaders, Arab leaders, squirm in their position, given the fact that they might be facing a retaliation of a higher degree when it comes to the issue of Palestine?
What happened in the World Cup made it clear that Palestinians and the Palestinian cause remain at the center of the Arab people's struggle and at the end of the Arab people's hearts and minds, and really of the hearts and minds of people of the world. I mean, we saw everyone from English fans to Brazilian fans yelling Free Palestine in the streets and at the matches, at these demonstrations, at these games and matches, and holding the Palestinian flag. And so, you know, it really just, what it did was it cast aside any illusions that this so-called normalization process was anything other than an agreement of the elites in order to further imperialist and Zionist crimes and reactionary repression. And it has absolutely no popular mandate or support at a popular level at all. And that was just made so visible in kind of this very normal way, because the people that were attending these matches or, you know, watching football were not doing so as political activists who were organized in a struggle. They were simply doing so as people. And that really reflects the depth of the commitment to the liberation of Palestine. And I mean, it's also a reflection of the fact that Palestinians are fighting back on a daily basis. Not only is the Palestinian resistance in Gaza very strong, Palestinians in the West Bank are continually fighting back through all means of popular and armed resistance. Palestinians outside are organizing. Palestinians in occupied Palestine 48 are defending their land against colonialism. It's really clear that Palestinians are fighting back. And when people fight back, and Palestinians, of course, have never stopped fighting back for 100 years of colonialism, that when people fight back, there is an even broader, deeper, and stronger level of support than there would be in any other circumstance. And so with the rise of the Palestinian resistance and this just fairly deep level of popular recognition and support for Palestine, it's clear that no signed paperwork between Zionists, imperialists, and reactionary rulers and kings would do anything to dampen the true enthusiasm and spirit of the Arab people, and indeed the people of the world, for justice in Palestine.
Indeed. Okay, so when you mentioned, Mazen Ghamsaya, the fact that these Arab leaders are not going to change their position, let's refer to another statement made by whom you mentioned, the organization by the name of the Moroccan Observatory Against Normalization, where he said that these so-called agreements are contributing to Israeli crimes against our Palestinian brothers. Tell us a little bit more about how that is happening. I mean, all I need to do is to look at is to put out here the fact that you have over 240 Palestinians that have been killed throughout the year now, which is one of the highest on record. So just that one particular fact shows that this so-called normalization is leading to deaths of Palestinians. How can then this be taken to a level even higher than what Charlotte Cates has said, which is, yes, Palestinians are mobilizing, but don't you think they should be mobilizing more, perhaps?
Yes, indeed. This is a very important point you raise. It is not just a formality of a diplomatic handshaking and laying wreaths and visiting Yad Vashem or whatever. The boost that the Zionists get from these arrangements, from these signatures, is a direct boost that basically empowers them and encourages them to do further ethnic cleansing and further destruction of Palestinian lives. I would link it directly, these collusions with some Arab regimes and the Zionist regime, I would link it directly to the fact that the Zionists just formed the government this week, actually, that is fascist and most right-wing, most extremist in their 70-plus year of history as a regime. And this is a natural outcome of them being encouraged and being supported by those regimes. Again, as Charlotte said, also under the tutelage of the big master, if you want, which is Washington, D.C., which runs the show and ensures that these things continue. So Washington orchestrates these players like Moroccan monarchy or the United Arab Emirates are like the Shakespearean tragic players or Greek tragedies that are playing their roles. They don't understand this play is it's heading to, but they are more than willing to play their part in this, again, like a Greek tragedy that's orchestrated in Washington and Tel Aviv, and it is not going well for them. And I think Charlotte is also right in that the Palestinian resistance, joined by the resistance from people around the world, it was not just Arabs or Muslims in Qatar. Even the British players refused to speak to an Israeli reporter who was there. So I think even the public in the West is growing tired of this game of support for oppression.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why a couple of years back this thing went into motion, I guess, Charlotte Cates. Our guests mentioned the UAE. I'd like to get your reaction to something that has been not circulating as much as it should, but since now there's a cabinet that has been formed, you have this personality by the name of Ben Gavir, who, according to one development, shook hands with the UAE ambassador during an event. And basically, this Ben Gavir boasted about the fact that that it is possible to make peace with Arab states and their leaders without making any concessions. Is that a window into what actually has transpired when it comes to the so-called Abraham Accords and normalization?
I mean, for these, for the rulers of the UAE, absolutely. I mean, I think that's very clear that the UAE sees itself as an integral part of a system that is dominated and run by the United States and U.S. imperialism for the interest of its corporations and its ruling class, and collaboration with Zionism is part and parcel of that. So it should come really as no surprise that rulers and officials of the UAE shook hands with fascists like Ben-Gvir. They don't, there's no commitment there to standing with the Palestinian people, to the Arab people, to fighting back against fascism. But what we see is that whenever masses have the opportunity to speak, whether that is in kind of this apolitical, this ostensibly apolitical context of the World Cup and football matches, or whether that's in the explicitly political context of rallying on the streets of Morocco against this project of normalization, that whenever the Arab masses have the chance to speak, and that includes the people of the Emirates, that there's a very clear rejection of Zionism, a very clear repulsion at these fascists like Ben-Gvir and the entire Zionist project in Palestine.
Thank you very much for that. We're fortunately out of time. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, thank you. And Mazen Qumsaya, thank you, Palestinian scientist and author there from Bethlehem. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Taghavi, and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's simple way of living and how careful he was in sticking to simplicity in every aspect of his life. In today's episode, we are going to discuss the events related to the liberation of Khurramshahr. Stay tuned, please. The liberation of Khurramshahr was without doubt the turning point in the history of the 8-year imposed war and one of the most important events of the history of the Islamic Revolution. Khurramshahr was occupied by the invading Iraqi army 35 days after the start of the invasion and Saddam's all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran. This, while the Ba'athist dictator had said that his army would occupy Khurramshahr in one day, the whole Khuzestan province in 3 days, and the entire Iran in 2 weeks, thanks to the stiff resistance of the people of the port city and the all-out support of the Iranian nation and the Iranian army. The Iraqi army intended to occupy Khurramshahr and then Abadan, Ahvaz, and Susangerd very fast, as it considered the move as a strategic victory. The invading army had dispatched 2 battalions at first, but facing the firm resistance of brave Iranian youth, sent more than 2 divisions to the region. The main bridge of Khurramshahr was closed 3 days before the final occupation of the city. Popular forces resisted bravely against aggressors, but after joining the Iraqi 11th Infantry Division to the besiegers, the city fell. Khurramshahr was occupied, but the people's resistance forced Saddam to retreat from his stance and be content with besieging Abadan. The strategic port of Khurramshahr was occupied for 576 days, and finally it was liberated on May 24, 1982, in Beit al-Muqaddas operation. The beautiful port city had ruined into a ruin, and the only undestroyed building was the main mosque of the city. The broadcasting of the news of liberation of Khurramshahr was the most joyous news during the 8-year war. It caused people distribute sweets and nuts and hold feasts on the streets of every city. People chanted Allahu Akbar on the roofs of houses. The liberation of Khurramshahr was a very big blow to the Iraqi army and Saddam himself. It seriously weakened the morale of the invading army. This day has been dubbed as the day of resistance, self-sacrifice, and victory in the Iranian calendar. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly believed that Khurramshahr was liberated by God. He wrote in his congratulatory message to the Iranian nation, "With certain belief in the ayah, there is no victory but from Allah, I thank the children of Islam and the valorous armed forces who were the means of God's power and who took out the country of the Imam of the Age from the clutches of cannibalistic wolves, which are puppets in the hands of superpowers, especially America, and who caused the chant of Allahu Akbar echo over the fresh city Khurramshahr that had plunged in blood by the wicked Western criminals and was called Khunin Shahr, or Bloody City." Imam Khomeini's wife was in the holy city of Mashhad on the day of liberation of Khurramshahr. But as soon as hearing this exhilarating news, she bought some sweets and gave them to be distributed among people. Ah! After the liberation of Khorramshahr, the renowned poet, late Muhammad Hossein Shahriar, came to Imam Khomeini's office to read and offer his recent poems for the Imam. The poems were full of praise for the Imam. But the whole time that Shahriar was reciting the poems, Imam Khomeini had put his head down with a gloomy and sad face. After finishing his poems, the Imam told him, "I thought that you had composed poems on liberators of Khorramshahr." Shahriar answered, "I have composed for the commander of the liberators of Khorramshahr." This was Imam Khomeini's usual reaction to those who praised him in their poems or speeches. He used to say that God has done everything and we are nothing before him.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.